Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today our guest is Ben Ford, a partner in Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. Today we're going to be doing a Supreme Court roundup of sorts, discussing the United States Supreme Court's recent decision in Bostock v. Clayton County, Georgia, which was issued at the end of June regarding Title VII and the rights of individuals who identify as homosexual under Title VII. Welcome, Ben.
Hi, Tawny. How are you today?
I am good. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show today.
Well, I'm really happy to be here, and I can't wait for this discussion about a very important case.
So I think it's important for all of our listeners to get a sense as to who you are and what your practice looks like so that they can understand why you and I are having this discussion versus maybe me and somebody else. So can you give our listeners a little bit of background about you and the type of law you practice specifically?
Sure. My name is Ben Ford. I'm a partner in a law firm here in Maine, and my job revolves around working with companies to help them establish good practices, HR practices that are compliant with the law, but also defending companies when charges are brought up against them. And so my specialty tends to turn more around on the litigation side as opposed to the policy side, but I still end up working a lot on policy and helping people, helping companies adjust to new laws as they come out, and helping them understand new laws and new cases as they come out as well.
You've made a lot of really good points there, and one of the things I think we need to stress to all of our listeners is that while you and I could geek out and have a one-hour conversation about all of the legal intricacies of the Supreme Court case and the interesting aspects
of it. I thought that's what we were doing, Tawny. I thought our job was to geek out.
Well, we will geek out in part, but my hope is that we're going to be able to provide listeners with some helpful takeaways to assist them in instituting or changing policies to make sure that they are in compliance with the Supreme Court's recent decision. Should we get started?
Yeah, let's get started. Maybe we'll throw in some geek stuff, you know, along the way if we can.
It's a possibility. I think that we're just going to start at the end, which everyone's going to be like, what are you even talking about, Tawny? But oftentimes when we're talking about the law, we'll give a factual synopsis first, and then we'll talk about how we get to what the decision is. But in this situation, I think it makes sense for us to jump right in as to what the Supreme Court's decision was on the issue and then backtrack as to how it got there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And especially for big cases like this at the Supreme Court, they will often consolidate cases. And so oftentimes the facts themselves, the details of the facts are not necessarily that critical because we're really talking about, in this case, we're talking about three different cases that they've consolidated into one decision.
Absolutely. So let's move the curtain and let's tell all of our listeners what the holding was from the Supreme Court. And the holding was that an employer who fires an individual for being homosexual or transgender fires that person for traits or actions it would not have questioned in members of a different sex, and accordingly, sex plays a necessary role in the decision and violates Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So, in much fewer words, if you terminate someone or take adverse action against another individual, an employee, as a result of them being homosexual or transgender, you have violated Title VII. Now, Ben, a lot of people and a lot of employers who I have talked to, once this decision came out, they looked at me and they said, yeah, but hasn't that always been the case? Has that always been the case?
Well, no, that hasn't always been the case. It has been the case in a number of circuits, in the number of federal circuits. They have begun interpreting Title VII as including being gay or being transgendered as a protected class, really at the beginning of about 2000. Many states have on their own books a law that would prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And so for a lot of states and a lot of circuits around the country, that has been the case for a long time. But it's not been the case for, I think it was, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Tony, but I believe it was the 11th Circuit that was overturned here. And the 11th Circuit covers sort of the southeastern United States. And it's not been the case in the 11th Circuit, and it's not been the case in a lot of states in that circuit that also don't have a ban on discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation in their own state laws. So we are talking about a significant number of people, and we're also talking about, you know, a lot of companies are national, have a national footprint. And so these types of laws, you know, if you have a national footprint, especially if you're doing business in the 11th Circuit, these types of laws and this decision is going to have can have a pretty big impact on you.
Absolutely. And the reason why we know that this case will have an impact is because it went to the Supreme Court. I mean, the Supreme Court was dealing with fact patterns from 2018. These weren't fact patterns that were coming from 2000 or 2004. These are new fact patterns in which in 2018, three employers terminated individuals only because they were gay or transgendered. They very specifically, there wasn't any disagreement between the parties. The defendants, the employers, in all of the cases that are involved in this decision, all admitted that the reason that the individual was terminated was because they were homosexual or transgendered, but that there was no liability because Title VII did not protect against individuals or provide protection for individuals as a result of those classifications. Now, clearly in those locations where these individuals were located, there wasn't state rights. And this comes down to something that I think is so confusing for employers generally throughout the country. Ben, can you give all of our listeners a little bit of an understanding as to how we should be analyzing and interpreting the differences between federal law, state law, and at this point in time, regional or local laws that play a role in the employer-employee relationship?
Sure. Yeah. So little civics lesson here. You know, we operate under several different layers of a legal system. There's the federal government, and that's the president of the United States, Donald Trump. That's your senators, those are your congresspeople. They pass laws that are federal statutes. And federal statutes are typically, when there's a question of interpretation or a violation, federal statutes are typically interpreted by federal courts. In your hometown in Portland, Maine here, we've got a federal court and we've got a state court. The federal court generally handles questions of federal law. And then below the federal law, we have states, and the states are allowed to pass their own statutes unless the federal law says that we are stepping in, we're covering this entire, you know, subject matter. So, for example, I'm trying to think of some examples. So, you know, regulatory things, the federal government will say we are, you know, pipelines, for example, we're going to handle all the law regarding pipelines, or shipping, we're going to handle all the law regarding shipping, and states aren't necessarily allowed to pass laws, you know, that would conflict with the laws that the federal government passes. In the realm of discrimination, states are allowed and usually do pass laws that would prohibit discrimination. And some of those laws may add additional protections to discrimination laws. What they can't do is they can't override what's already in a federal statute. So, you know, you can say, Like, take, for example, if a state didn't have a law prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, but the circuit that state happened to be in did, then if somebody was fired on the basis of sexual orientation, they can bring a suit. They wouldn't bring it in state court. They'd bring it in federal court, and they would say that their Title VII, which is a federal statute, their Title VII rights have been violated. In other states where there is anti-discrimination laws on the books that grant more rights than the federal law, then you would see cases being brought into state court rather than federal court. And in fact, in Maine, we saw that quite a bit. A lot of the law on the books and the judges' decisions that we see in Maine around this issue were brought in state court because it wasn't clear until the beginning of really after 2000 in the First Circuit here. It wasn't clear that the federal law was going to uphold a ban on discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. So those cases were often brought in state court.
So it's important to understand specifically for this discussion, both the fundamental civics aspects of things, because it comes up in the court's decision, specifically the dissenting opinion, some civic lesson issues, but more importantly, the language that is specifically used by Congress in Title VII forms the basis of all of the opinions. So when I say all of the opinions, I mean the majority opinion and the two dissenting opinions. So Title VII has a very limited protection. So it provides that it will be unlawful for an employer to fail or refuse to hire or to discharge any individual or otherwise discriminate against any individual because of such individuals, and then it lists race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. So it only includes five specific protected categories. So in my mind, Ben, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, but people are protected on the basis of age, right? Isn't that included in Title VII?
It's not. No, age is not, nor is disability. So Title VII is really limited to those particular characteristics. Now, of course, age is prohibited under a different statute, and disability discrimination is prohibited under a different statute. So Title VII is really focused on just those specific attributes.
And that's what permits states to create more encompassing or more protective laws for employees, is that we know that states can expand on the protections provided under federal law, but they couldn't minimize those protections, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then, you know, the states are also hemmed in by other, you know, constitutional provisions that would, that might affect an employer. There aren't many, because in general, constitutional provisions generally only limit the government's power, not a private employer's power. But there's other legal considerations in there that an employer would have to look at as well.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show, and I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez. And today we're talking with attorney Ben Ford concerning the Supreme Court's recent decision in Bustock v. Clayton County, which held that the term sex in Title VII protects employees from discrimination in the work environment on account of sexual orientation and gender identity. Now, when this case went up to the Supreme Court, we had a circuit split. Isn't that correct, Ben?
That is correct. And generally, when you see those circuit splits, they're generally ripe for a Supreme Court review. The Supreme Court likes to resolve major big questions in society. Unlike many other courts, the Supreme Court can decide what cases it wants to hear. And so it's not going to spend a lot of time looking at things that are well-settled law. It's going to look at things that are major disputes out there among the circuits. And maybe we should talk a little bit about what a circuit is, Tawny.
I think that makes a ton of sense. So right now, the country itself is split up into a multitude of different circuits, and that means that each state has a court or multiple courts. So in Maine, you have the District of Maine, but in places such as Pennsylvania, you have the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, the Middle District of Pennsylvania, and the Western District of Pennsylvania. So depending on the populous nature of a state, you might have multiple different federal districts within that state. And then after you deal with kind of the state level, if you don't like the opinion that you get there or the ruling that's entered, you have the ability to appeal to what's known as a court of appeals. And the court of appeals are divided into different circuits. So we have 13 appellate courts. So that accounts for 12 different circuits or districts, and then what's known as the D.C. Court of Appeals. So for people who live in Maine or who live in New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, and Puerto Rico, we're in what's known as the First Circuit. But individuals who live in Connecticut or New York, New Jersey, that's called the Second Circuit. So each of these circuit courts hears appeals from different state federal courts. And in this situation, there was split between different circuits, and specifically the Second Circuit and the Sixth Circuit said that an individual was protected under Title VII, but the 11th Circuit was saying that there was no protection. And that's important to understand kind of as we move into understanding the court's decision itself. But that also leads us to our first break. So we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobsinme.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobsinme to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by cmacareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today our guest is Ben Ford, a partner in Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. Today we're doing a Supreme Court roundup of sorts, talking specifically about the Supreme Court's recent decision in Bustock v. Clayton County, Georgia. In that case, the Supreme Court held that the term sex in Title VII protects employees from discrimination in the workplace on account of sexual orientation and gender identity. Prior to the break, we gave a fundamental civics lesson to understand how we got to the Supreme Court. We talked about the circuit split. We talked about the different protections that were provided under state law as well as Title VII. Ben, let's jump in and talk about the decision itself. So who was there a split in the decision itself? Did everyone agree that sex is protected under Title VII? Or give me a little bit of an understanding as to how the court came down.
Sure. So this was a split decision. You had Justices Alito, Kavanaugh, and Thomas dissenting or voting no in this case. Kavanaugh and Alito both wrote different dissenting opinions. And then in the majority, you had some surprises, which has been this, seems like this term has really included a number of surprises. You had Chief Justice Roberts in the majority, and you also had Justice Gorsuch in the majority as well. And Justice Gorsuch is the one who actually wrote the majority opinion here. And what they really came down to was their holding was somewhat simple. What they said was, if you are making a decision that you're going to discriminate on the basis of, let's just say in this case, someone's status as homosexual, you cannot reach that decision without first making a decision with respect to their gender. So, for example, in your definition, in their definition, a homosexual is somebody, is a homosexual man, is a man who is sexually attracted to other men. Well, you can't say that you don't like a man that's sexually attracted to another man without saying that you're recognizing that the person is a man. The same thing with women. You can't say that that a homosexual woman is a woman who is sexually attracted to another woman without saying that you're actually looking at the fact that there's a woman there that you're discriminating against. So what they said was, you can say, if you say, okay, I like all men, I don't have a problem with men, I don't have a problem with women, I don't have a problem with heterosexual men, meaning I don't have a problem with men who are attracted to women, you can't also say that, but I also have a problem with men who are attracted to men, because now you're discriminating on the basis of sex.
Some people, Ben, would argue that this takes a very expansive view of the term sex, that an individual or the individuals who are a part of this case wouldn't say that they were terminated because of their sex. They weren't terminated because they are a man or terminated because they are a woman. Thus, they weren't terminated with regards to their sex, but instead they were terminated because of their sexual orientation or because of their gender identity. If we look at the opinion of the majority, does it take that language or that argument into account?
Yeah, they absolutely do. I mean, what they say is we're not saying that homosexuality itself, the act of homosexuality, is a protected characteristic. What they're saying is that you're not allowed to discriminate on the basis of what you think makes a man, what you think makes a woman, what you think is acceptable behavior on the part of a man, and what you think is acceptable behavior, sexual behavior on the part of a woman. That's the part that we are going to say that you can't discriminate against, or that's the basis of your decision that's prohibited by this opinion.
I know at the beginning of our discussion, we said we are going to start at the end and work backwards. I think this might be a good time for us just to give listeners an understanding as to the facts and the individuals who are on the front lines of this discussion and why we even have these cases in the court. So we had three different plaintiffs, and all of these cases were consolidated into one and brought before the Supreme Court under the title Bustock v. Clayton County, Georgia. Now, Gerald Bustock was an employee of Clayton County, Georgia, and he'd been employed there for a long time, actually. But what happened is he was fired for quote-unquote conduct that was unbecoming of a county employee. And this happened shortly after he began participating in a gay recreational softball league. So that's the first case that serves as the foundational discussion of how we get to the Supreme Court. And then the second case involves an individual by the name of Donald Zarda, and he was employed by an entity called Altitude Express. And he had mentioned to his employer that he was gay, and as a result, that they fired him. And then the last case involves an individual named Amy Stevens, and she presented herself as male at the time in which she was hired, and then later informed her employer that she planned to live and work full-time as a woman. And upon her notifying her employer of that, they told her that she was terminated. So we have these three cases that come before the court that all have factually different discussion and circumstances. But at the base of all of this is that question of how expansive are the words within Title VII. Is that correct, Ben?
That is correct. And I think looking at the facts in the case, you really do get a little bit better understanding of what the court was saying here. You know, the issue here is that take Mr. Bustock's case, you know, the county was saying that we don't approve of your behavior of being attracted to men. And the reason why we don't approve of your behavior of being attracted to men is because you yourself are a man. And what the court is saying is, in that particular situation, you're saying that you're telling this man what he can or cannot do.
You've been listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today we're talking with attorney Ben Ford concerning the Supreme Court's recent decision in Bustock v. Clayton County, which held that the term sex in Title VII protects employees from discrimination in the work environment on account of sexual orientation and gender identity. Now, Ben, at the beginning of the program, we talked about the importance of language specifically, and I read off the quote from Title VII. A lot of individuals would say that we need to look at the legislative history, and we need to look at what Congress's intent was when it created the statute to determine what the term sex means. Did the court in this situation kind of analyze or consider what Congress in 1964, when the Civil Rights Act was passed, was looking to accomplish in including the language sex?
Well, in the majority opinion, the court said we don't need to look at the legislative history. It is the court's job to consider what the Congress that passed the statute was considering, you know, what their intent was in 1964. But the court will only look at legislative history when they find a term is ambiguous, when it needs interpretation. And in this case, surprisingly, you know, really for Gorsuch to take an opinion such as this, they said that no, that the term sex is unambiguous. And the reason why they got to that result, that the term sex is unambiguous, is because of the way that they're analyzing the behavior that's being discriminated against here. So there's no question that you are treating men differently than you are treating women, and there's no question that you are treating heterosexual people differently than you're treating homosexual people differently.
I think that one of the really interesting aspects that hits the nail right on the head and kind of takes everything you've just said is this quote within the opinion itself that says, if changing the employee's sex would have yielded a different choice by the employer, a statutory violation has occurred. As you've pointed out or described, I mean, if a man loves a man and a woman loves a man, but we treat the man who loves a man differently than the woman who loves a man, then in and of itself, a violation of Title VII has occurred because we treat two individuals differently based off of their sex, correct?
Yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, Justice Gorsuch, you know, put it very succinctly in that case. It was but for that person's gender, but for Mr. Bustock's gender, he would not have been fired.
Now, in further discussing Supreme Court history and what the intention of Title VII was at the time in which it was created, the court really focuses on three other past decisions that it's made. Phillips v. Martin Marietta Corporation, Los Angeles Department of Water and Power v. Manhart, and Oncale v. Sun Owner Offshore Services. Now, were those cases that very clearly said the definition of sex is easy and it's that Title VII protects women against discrimination? Because arguably during the time frame in which Title VII was created, I think a lot of people would indicate that it was created to protect women and not specifically to protect men. Would you agree with that based off of what we know about what was happening culturally in the United States at that time frame.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Those cases expanded Title VII's protection to men. Well, I should say expanded. I should say it interpreted the language to apply to men just as much as it applied to women. I think the Onkali case is particularly interesting because that case also, it applied the concept of sexual harassment to men as well as to women. So in that case, you had that's a same-sex sexual harassment case, and the court said, yeah, that's also prohibited.
So even though, and some people would argue that when Title VII was created, Congress wasn't thinking about a situation in which men were protected from harassment by other men, the term sex is so broad within the statute that the Supreme Court found that it was within the purview of Title VII, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that, you know, going back to the Onkali case, which the facts are particularly striking. So what was so interesting about this Onkali case is that it was written by Justice Scalia. And, you know, Justice Scalia is the famous textualist. And even Justice Scalia said that male-on-male harassment, he says, quote, was assuredly not the principal evil Congress was concerned with when it enacted Title VII. Statutory prohibitions often go beyond the principal evil to cover reasonably comparable evils, and it is ultimately the provisions of our laws rather than the principal concerns of our legislators by which we are governed. So that was a pretty expansive quote from Justice Scalia there, and the majority opinion in this case, in the Bostock case, built upon that and said, look, even Justice Scalia recognized, so we're not necessarily beholden to what the individual legislators in 1964 thought. What we are beholden to is what the words say.
And I think that's interesting because we see a lot of circuit court decisions that were dealing with this issue. And in those cases, they included language that said Title VII is meant to be read in the most encompassing format, and its intent is to be read broadly. But then we see in this decision from the Supreme Court that they don't include any of that specific language regarding broad reading and interpretation, but instead, on the second page, getting right to the heart of the issue, they say it is clear that Title VII protects individuals on the basis of homosexuality and gender identity. Now, this is crazy to a lot of individuals because we've gone 1964 to 2020. So we have gone now 56 years. And it hasn't been clear. So for the Supreme Court in the opening statement to say this is clear, I think hit a lot of people on top of the head, whether they agreed that the protection should be extended to this class of individuals or not. The case itself, to start with, the finding is clear, I think to a lot of people caused almost a belly laugh.
Yeah, it's true. If it was clear, you wouldn't need a Supreme Court, right?
Absolutely.
If it was clear, we wouldn't need an opinion. So it's far from clear. I do sometimes wonder whether saying that things are clear, or saying that things are self-evident, or saying that, you know, this is not really in dispute, is like Tourette's for lawyers. Like we tend to often say, oh, clearly this and clearly that, when of course if you have to say something is clearly this or clearly that, then it's anything but clear.
On that note, we're going to take a break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. JobsandME.com has been matching main employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their QuickPost product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs and ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsandme.com. That's jobsandme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Life's never perfect, but as realtors, we know living it in the perfect place can make a big difference.
Imagine
hiding from your screeching children in that spacious walk-in closet, watching the neighbor's dog poop on the freshly sodded grass you negotiated during closing, dropping your cell phone in the toilet of the spa-like five-piece bathroom again. So get the perfect place to house all of life's imperfections. Get Realtor. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts. StopWrecks.org.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today our guest is Ben Ford, a partner in Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. We've spent the morning discussing the Supreme Court's recent decision in Bustock v. Clayton County Holding, which found that the term sex within Title VII protects employees from discrimination in the work environment on account of sexual orientation and gender identity. Now, Ben, earlier in the program, we discussed the fact that this wasn't a unanimous opinion, but in fact, there were two dissenting opinions. Is that correct?
Yes, there were. There was a very, very long dissent filed by Justice Alito and a somewhat more succinct dissent filed by Justice Kavanaugh.
Give me a sense as to what Judge Alito argued in opposition or in the dissenting opinion as to why he believed that Title VII and the term sex did not encompass sexual orientation or gender identity in this situation.
Well, most dissents have a theme, and the theme is usually when a conservative judge is dissenting, the theme is usually that you're legislating from the bench, you're creating law. Judges are not allowed to create law. And so when you want to criticize a decision from the right, you usually criticize it from the standpoint of you're creating law. When you criticize a decision from the left, you might criticize it on the basis that it's not constitutional for other reasons. So here, you know, Justice Alito is saying that you are creating law. And the reason why you're creating law is because there's nothing in that statute that creates a protected class on the basis of sexual orientation. There's nothing in there. It just says sex, and sex means gender, essentially. Sex means man, means you're not allowed to discriminate on the basis of a person being a man, or you're not allowed to discriminate on the basis of a person being a woman, point blank, end of story. They often go on to say, actually both dissents go on to make this point, which is, if Congress had decided or if Congress had wanted to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, they would have done that. And in fact, they have done that in certain situations, in certain statutes. And they've also tried to do that when they try to amend Title VII throughout the 40-some-odd years now. But they've failed to amend Title VII, and so therefore, because they have tried and failed to amend Title VII, we know that Title VII does not protect against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or on the status of being transgender. That's the argument, roughly, that Alito makes.
Now, it's interesting, and it caused me a little bit of a chuckle, because there's a quote in Justice Alito's dissent that says that the majority opinion is like a pirate ship. It sails under a textualist flag, but what it actually represents is a theory that courts should update old statutes so that those statutes better reflect the current values of our society. And it's interesting because a lot of people were very surprised to see that Gorchak, who identifies himself as a textualist, joined in the opinion of the majority, and also that Justice Roberts also was in the majority opinion, who also is seen kind of more from a textualist or conservative standpoint. So then to see Justice Alito really focusing in on this language is interesting because I think a lot of people would say that the majority opinion also took a textualist approach to writing the decision. But this opinion, Alito's opinion, Kavanaugh's opinion, the majority opinion all take textualism and define it in very different ways as to what the term sex means now, what it meant in 1964, and how that plays a role in the current circumstances that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, it's interesting. If Scalia were still on the court, if he was still alive, I actually think that he'd probably be in the majority on this case because I think Gorsuch's reasoning, I think Scalia would have to agree with. And I know it's funny, Alito said, don't try to enlist Justice Scalia to the cause of this new form of textualism. But I actually think that he probably would agree with this. This is what this is. This isn't a new, we're not creating new law here. We have a novel argument that's being applied to old law. And Justice Scalia, I think he would say, look, you know, we have situations evolve. The words are what they are, and if you have new arguments and new situations, you have to be able to apply old law to new situations, and that's exactly what the majority has done here.
Now, if we move to Kavanaugh's dissent, he makes a really interesting argument, and his, again, goes to textualism argument, but he defines a difference between the literal meaning of the text and the ordinary meaning of the text. And in it, he uses a really interesting example that I'll share, and then I'd love to get your thoughts on that, Ben. If you are talking about the difference between ordinary meaning and literal meaning of a statute, let's say that there's a statutory ban on vehicles in a park, and that statutory ban would thus literally encompass a baby stroller, but no good judge would interpret the statute that way because the word vehicle in its ordinary meaning does not encompass baby strollers. So here he seems to be saying while sex may, you know, encompass the current situations, and I think using that example he would say that, that it does not use what the ordinary meaning of the term sex is, which would be only the gender in which an individual is born with.
Yeah, it's a good argument, but it was totally misplaced. The reason why this case was decided the way it was because the court can take these facts and say, as you said earlier in this show, Tawny, that if the sexes were to change, then the person wouldn't have been fired. And so you can't say that we're interpreting sex to include homosexuality here. We're interpreting sex to mean gender, to mean the gender of the person being discriminated against. And that's why Kavanaugh's argument completely falls apart. It falls apart for a number of other reasons. I don't think when you get to interpreting federal statutes, which are written by lawyers, very good lawyers, and lawyers that make a profession of drafting statutes, I don't think you're going to get too much distinction between what's an ordinary meaning and what's a literal meaning. And you know, every word in the statute is being negotiated over and being fought over. And so the difference between ordinary and literal means really very little when you're at this level of litigation. And when you're litigating against a statute that was as prominent as it was in 1964. So I think that he tries to make a good argument. He makes the best argument he can, but ultimately it fails because the court was able to, or the litigators were able to present an argument that showed that these people who are being discriminated are being discriminated on the basis of their gender, not on the basis of their sexual orientation.
It's also interesting, I think, in Kavanaugh's opinion, and tell me if you picked up on this as well, but he opens up the whole opinion, almost framing it in a way in which he's saying this is an academic issue. I myself, and he personally brings himself into the discussion, notes that he does not believe gay and lesbian Americans should be treated as social outcasts or as inferior in dignity and worth. But, and I mean, anytime you get that but, it's always interesting to hear what's going to come next. But he says separation of powers dictates that the court not make or amend the law, and Title VII does not prohibit employment discrimination because of sexual orientation. So he falls back on fourth grade civics, you know, exactly what you had discussed at the beginning of the program, which is the separation of powers argument, that this should be left to the legislature, and that the term sex does not, in fact, encompass sexual orientation or gender identity.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a judge's personal opinion should never make it into a written decision. We don't care what a judge's personal opinion is, and it's not a judge's role to even state what their personal opinion is as a caveat to what they're about to say. Justice Kavanaugh's opinion with respect to gay and lesbian people and people transgendered, it's completely irrelevant. All that's relevant is the law here, and does this law apply to these facts or not? So the fact that a judge, that Justice Kavanaugh has to state that, suggests to me that, you know, maybe there's some other issues going on there.
And on that note, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez, your host from Verrill. And today our guest is Ben Ford, a partner in Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. And we've spent this episode discussing the Supreme Court's recent decision in Bostock v. Clayton County, Georgia, which held that the term sex in Title VII protects employees from discrimination in the work environment on account of sexual orientation and gender identity. Now, Ben, you and I have spent a ton of time talking about the background of the cases, the majority opinion, the dissenting opinion, some of the language that's included within the opinion itself and why it's interesting. But how does this affect companies on the ground in an everyday setting, and what should they be doing as a result of this opinion?
Well, you know, if you're in a state that already has a law like this on the books, or if you're in a circuit that's already held that Title VII prohibits discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or on the basis of someone being transgendered, then you shouldn't be doing anything but complying with the law that's already been in existence for now almost more than a decade. If you're in a state that doesn't have these laws on the books, you need to change your policies and you need to update your policies and make sure that they include sexual orientation and transgendered in your policies as well. But I think it's also worth probably taking a little bit deeper look into how this decision works and the logic of this decision. If you have policies that affect men but not women, even though the policy itself is facially neutral, you should take a hard look at that. Now, I'll give you an example. One of the cases they cited was a case where an employer charges more in pension contributions for women than they do for men. And the reasoning behind that is that actuarially speaking, women live longer than men. And therefore, if you're going to have a pension that will pay you for the rest of your life, you're going to live longer as a woman than you're going to live as a man. And so therefore, women should be charged more. Now, on the face of it, that's saying, well, we're charging more because actuarially speaking, you know, women live longer, but you're treating women differently than you're treating men. And so it's really important to examine policies if those policies are unique or if they're different in any way, and look at those policies through the lens of, does this policy affect women differently than men?
I think that's a really good point. And even if you have been operating in a state in which this has been the law in the books for an extended period of time, both that Title VII protects individuals on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation, or you live in a jurisdiction in which the Fair Employment Practices legislation of your state or municipality provides protections, it never hurts to just do a quick review of your policy and make sure that you include language that says that individuals will not be discriminated against as a result of sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, and all other classes that are protected by law, whether state, federal, or local.
Yeah, and it's one thing to change the policy, but it's another thing to change behavior. And so you need to change the policy, and then you also need to include training on people and make sure that people are aware of the change in policy, and then keep an eye out for behavior that's not consistent with that policy.
That's a really important point to make, Ben, and I think that's a really good place for us to stop our discussion. So thank you so much for taking time today to discuss this opinion and the effect that it has on employers throughout the country. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Tani, thanks for geeking out with me.
No problem. So you've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Stay tuned for the HR Tip of the Week.
And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
Hi, I'm Richard Moon from Verrill. This week's Tip of the Week is, you need to have an answer for the employee who wants to continue to work remotely, but you want that employee to return to work. You need to start with a process for assessing this request. Each request may have a different basis behind it. Some of the requests will simply because an employee may want to continue to have that enriched unemployment benefit that pays him more to stay home than to come to work. But that may not be something you approve of. There's no obligation under those circumstances that you allow the person to continue work remotely. But what about the employee who has a child at home, or a parent at home, or someone that they need to be there for, they feel, now that schools are closed, summer camps are closed? You should look at these issues as you consider what your long-term employment needs for your company.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.